The seaside town of Weymouth is a place I have thought of coming to for many years. Mrs. Simons makes special mention of this pier, recommending particularly that it be visited in the evening, when it becomes lit up with bulbs of various colours. And so I have decided to sit down here on this bench and await the event. It is now fully 2 days since my meeting with Miss Kenton in the tea lounge of the Rose Garden Hotel in Little Compton, for indeed that was where we met. Miss Kenton surprised me by coming to the hotel, knowing as she did from my letter of my intention to stay there. Miss Kenton rose as I entered the tea lounge, smiled, and held out her hand to me.
Ah, Mr. Stevens, how nice to see you again.
She had naturally aged somewhat, but to my eyes at least she seemed to have done so very gracefully. Her figure remained slim, her posture as upright as ever. She had maintained, too, her old way of holding her head in a manner that verged on the defiant. By and large, the Miss Kenton I saw before me looked surprisingly similar to the person who had inhabited my memory over these years. It was extremely pleasing to see her again. As we continued to talk, I thought I began to notice more subtle changes which the years had wrought on her. For instance, Miss Kenton appeared somehow slower. I could not escape the feeling that the spark, which had once made her such a lively and at times volatile person, seemed now to have gone. In fact, every now and then I thought I glimpsed something like sadness in her expression. After a little while, our conversation took a more personal turn. It was not so much the content as the little smiles, her small ironic inflections here and there, certain gestures which began to recall the rhythms and habits of our conversations from all those years ago. It was around this point that I was able to establish some facts concerning her present circumstances. I learned that although she had indeed left her home for a period of 4 or 5 days, she had returned, and Mr. Benn had been very pleased to have her back. Miss Kenton went on to talk more generally about her husband and of her daughter, who is now married and expecting a child in the autumn. For my own part, I tried to describe to her as best I could the Darlington Hall of today. Miss Kenton, I thought, became visibly happier when I talked about the house, and soon we were recollecting various old memories, frequently laughing over them. Indeed, one could hardly believe 2 whole hours had elapsed when Miss Kenton looked up at the clock and said she would have to be returning home. On establishing that she would have to walk to a bus stop a little way out of the village, I insisted on running her there in the Ford. Soon we were motoring down the village high street. Miss Kenton, who had been sitting quietly, turned to me, saying, "What are you smiling to yourself about, Mr. Stevens?" "Oh, you must excuse me, Mrs. Benn, but I was just recalling certain things you wrote in your letter. For instance," I said with a laugh, "at one point you write, 'The rest of my life stretches out like an emptiness before me.'" "Oh, really, Mr. Stevens," she said, "I couldn't have written any such thing." "Oh, I assure you, you did, Mrs. Benn." "Oh, dear. Well, there are some days when I feel like that, but they pass quickly enough. Let me assure you, Mr. Stevens, my life does not stretch out emptily before me. For one thing, we are looking forward to the grandchild." "And what about you, Mr. Stevens? What does the future hold for you back at Darlington Hall?"
"Well, I know I'm not awaited by emptiness. No, no, there's work, work, and more work."
We both laughed at this. Then Miss Kenton pointed out the bus shelter. As we approached it, she said, "Will you wait with me, Mr. Stevens? The bus will only be a few minutes." After we had been waiting in silence for a few minutes, I finally brought myself to say, "Excuse me, Mrs. Benn, but I wonder if you would perhaps permit me to ask you something of a rather personal order."
"Certainly, Mr. Stevens. We are old friends, after all."
"Indeed, as you say, we are old friends. But the fact is, the letters I have had from you over the years have tended to suggest that you are rather unhappy. I simply wondered if you were being ill-treated in some way.
Forgive me, but I would feel foolish if I had come all this way and not at least asked you.
Mr. Stevens, I'm very touched you should be so concerned. My husband does not mistreat me at all in any way. He's not in the least a cruel or ill-tempered man. Well, I must say that does take a load from my mind. It's just that the fact remains you do not seem to have been happy over the years. Well, one is rather mystified as to the cause. I looked out into the drizzle. Eventually I heard Miss Kenton say behind me, "Mr. Stevens, how can I explain? I hardly know myself. I suppose you're asking me whether or not I love my husband." "Oh, really, Mrs. Benn, I would hardly presume. I feel I should answer you, Mr. Stevens. Yes, I do love my husband. I didn't at first. When I left Arlington Hall, I never realized I was really, truly leaving. I believe I thought of it as simply another ruse, Mr. Stevens, to annoy you. It was a shock to come out here, find myself married. For a long time, I was very unhappy indeed. But then, year after year went by, and one day I realized I loved my husband." Miss Kenton fell silent again for a moment. Then she went on, "But that doesn't mean to say, of course, there aren't occasions now and then when you think to yourself, what a terrible mistake I've made with my life. And you get to thinking about a different life. A better life you might have had. For instance, I get to thinking about a life I may have had with you, Mr. Stevens. And I suppose that's when I get angry over some trivial little thing and leave. But each time I do so, I realize my rightful place is with my husband. After all, there's no turning back the clock now. One can't be forever dwelling on what might have been." I do not think I responded immediately, for it took me a moment or two to fully digest these words. Moreover, their implications were such as to provoke a certain degree of sorrow within me. Indeed, why should I not admit it? At that moment, my heart was breaking. Before long, however, I turned to her and said with a smile, "You're very correct, Mrs. Benn. We must each of us be grateful for what we do have. You really mustn't let any more foolish ideas come between yourself and the happiness you deserve." "Of course you're right, Mr. Stevens. You're so kind." Only as the bus pulled up did I glance at Miss Kenton and perceive that her eyes had filled with tears. I smiled and said, "Now, Mrs. Benn, you must take good care of yourself. You must do all you can to make these years happy ones for yourself and your husband. We may never meet again, Mrs. Benn, so I would ask you to take good heed of what I am saying."
"I will, Mr. Stevens. Thank you. It was so nice to see you again."
"It was a great pleasure to see you again, Mrs. Benn." The pier lights have been switched on, and behind me a crowd of people have just given a loud cheer to greet this event. It would seem that all these people who have been gathering on this pier are now willing night to fall. This confirms very aptly the point made by the man who, until a little while ago, was sitting here beside me on this bench. His claim was that for a great many people, the evening was the best part of the day, the part they most looked forward to. Of course, the man had been speaking figuratively, but it is rather interesting to see his words borne out so immediately at the literal level. He had been sitting here next to me for some minutes without my noticing him. In fact, I do not think I registered his presence on the bench at all until he declared out loud, "Sea air does you a lot of good. Doctor says it does you good. So I come up here as much as the weather will let me." The man went on to tell me about his various ailments. I really only started to pay attention when he happened to mention that until his retirement, he had been a butler of a nearby house. At this point, I thought it appropriate to reveal my identity, and my companion seemed suitably impressed. "And here was I trying to explain it all to you," he said with a laugh. "So, you had a big staff, I suppose, before the war, I mean.
He seemed genuinely interested, so I confess I did spend a little time telling him about Darlington Hall in former days. We then proceeded to sit there together quietly for several moments. The fact is, I said after a while, I gave my best to Lord Darlington. I gave him the very best I had to give, and now, well, I find I do not have a great deal more to give. Since my new employer, Mr. Faraday, arrived, I've tried very hard to provide the sort of service I would like him to have. I've tried and tried. Whatever I do, I find I'm far from reaching the standards I once set myself. It's no use. I've given what I had to give. I gave it all to Lord Darlington. Oh, dear, mate, here. You want a hanky? No, I've got one here somewhere. Now, here we are. Oh, dear, no, thank you, no. I'm very sorry. I'm afraid the travelling has tired me. I'm very sorry. You must have been very attached to this Lord whatever. Lord Darlington wasn't a bad man. And at least he had the privilege of being able to say at the end of his life that he made his own mistakes. As for myself, I cannot even claim that. You see, I trusted in his lordship's wisdom. I can't even say I made my own mistakes. Really, what dignity is there in that? Now, look here, mate, you can't do your job as well as you used to, but it's the same for all of us, see? And I believe it was then he said, "You've done your day's work. Now you can put your feet up. The evening's the best part of the day." Perhaps there is something to his advice that I should cease looking back so much and try to make the best of what remains of my day. What is the point in worrying about what one could or could not have done to control the course one's life took? Surely it is enough that the likes of you and I at least try to make our contribution count for something true and worthy. And if some of us are prepared to sacrifice much to pursue such aspirations, surely that is in itself cause for pride and contentment. There is a group of 6 or 7 people gathered just a little way behind me. I naturally assumed at first that they were a group of friends out for the evening, but as I listened to their exchanges, it became apparent they were strangers who had just happened upon one another here on this spot. Listening to them now, I can hear them exchanging one bantering remark after another. Perhaps it is indeed time I began to look at this whole matter of bantering more enthusiastically. After all, it is not such a foolish thing to indulge in, particularly if it is the case that in bantering lies the key to human warmth. Perhaps then, when I return to Darlington Hall tomorrow, I will begin practicing with renewed effort. I should hope that by the time of my employer's return, I shall be in a position to pleasantly surprise him.
John Moffat was reading The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro. It was abridged by Catherine Chikowska, and the producer was Marilyn Imrie.